Good day.
Good day.
Good day. Welcome to another episode of Forge Side Chat, a podcast about blacksmithing, bladesmithing, and everything in between, with a heavy emphasis on the Great White North.
Is that the emphasis or emphasis?
Emphasis.
I'm trying to figure out which level of syllables we're using today.
The syllables?
That was good old Nick Welsh coming in for the intro there, talking about our side of the country north of the 49, Canada, eh? And today on the show, we've got Paul Kraskowski joining us out of the Toronto area. He's actually residing in the Kent region right now. And Paul does amazing talent come to mind when you look at Paul? Extremely hardworking, dedicated. What other good things can we say about this kid? He's a young man. A young man has been doing this for like 8 years now. Went to school for welding when he was 18. While he was in school for 18, found himself some shop space in the Toronto area and actually started working his business while he was in school for welding. Like, dude's a freaking hard worker. So, dude, welcome to the show, Paul. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Right on. So you build axes. That's your jam, isn't it?
Yeah, so the main work I do is axe making. I do sometimes other tools, but most of my work is about axes, yeah.
Right on. Where did you get the inspiration to start with axes? I mean, let's face it, a lot of people got into knives.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people like knives for some reason. You know, and for some reason, I like axes. But I was always interested in kind of outdoorsy stuff. Like, I used to watch stuff on YouTube, and so I would see things there. And that always interested me. But, you know, I don't know why kind of axes catched my imagination instead of knives. But I do remember a couple things. Like, back in, I didn't know that you could even, like, you know, you can make axes, you can do this sort of thing. But I remember back in, I don't know, 2011, 2012, the John Neiman axes took off. And so I said, okay, so you can actually, like, you know, make this stuff and kind of make a business out of it. And so that was kind of from a business side. I saw that, you know, at least it can potentially be sustainable. And then from the other side, kind of artistically, let's call it, or like axes that really caught my eye back then. There was a maker, and I don't know what his, I think it's, he's on Instagram right now. It's, I think, Mikhail Artmenyev, something like that. He does, the website was artaxe.ru, artaxe.ru. And his axes were like something out of this world. It was completely different than anything anybody was doing. That was kind of my inspiration.
.ru, was that Russia?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah, yes, that's Russia.
I don't know if the website is still active, because this was back 10 years ago. Oh, no, it's not. But I think his name is Mikhail Artmenyev, and I found him on Instagram.
Very interesting, man.
You know, it might be a different name entirely.
No.
It might just be something in my memory. I'll try to find it and link it to you.
Sure, bud.
That's awesome. So, at 18, you figured out that you were going to do this. I mean, went to school for welding. While you're in school for welding, you decided that you were going to start a blacksmith shop. How big was that space?
The space I started was, I believe from memory, it was 16 by 20, but it might have been 16 by 25. Might have been
pretty small space.
Yeah, it wasn't that large. It wasn't too large, but you know, I could fit the basics in there, like a forge, a power hammer, a vise, an anvil, like the welding table, shelf, drill press. you know, it's kind of divided in half. The forging space took up half, and the kind of grinding and other space took up the other half.
Yeah. Did you actually have it separated, or was it just kind of loosely separated?
No, it wasn't separated at all, because it's, you know, if you're dealing with 350 square feet, it's kind of claustrophobic as is, right? Mm-hmm. So I had it divided because it was kind of in a warehouse. I had it divided. I got these welding screens somewhere. Like, I got 20 of them for a really good price, and I tied them together and divided it from the rest of the warehouse, and that was my corner.
Right. Crazy, dude.
That's awesome.
What took you into school for you? You know, man, Nick, I realized something, dude. We started this off like, and we did this last episode too, I think. Anyways, we didn't really like talk about what we've been up to this week and how things are going for us. Like, that's usually how the show starts off, as we do the intro, introduce the guest, and then we kind of be like, so what have you been up to this week? And we totally bypass that. Let's save that for later, maybe, hey?
Yeah, no, that sounds good. Honestly, yeah, I was so excited to, like, after looking at Paul's Instagram, I was so excited to get in to talk to him about making axes and that kind of stuff. I mean, I've actually just started to tool up to start making some axes. I bought some 4140 yesterday. You inspired me to make some more axes there, Paul. Sorry. But there you go. I was just so excited to hear that. I was like, oh, tell me, Paul. Well, let's pick your brain. Let's find out what's making you tick and how you got into this. So, yeah.
And so, like, 8 years ago, you decided, 8-ish years ago, you decided to go to school for welding. Was there, what brought you into the welding world there, dude?
Well, when I was in high school, you know, there's grade 10. At grade 10, you have to decide your course. Like, into grade 11, grade 12, you either pick college or academic courses, or college or university. And I was, you know, really looking at all that. And I started kind of calculating everything and looking at course syllabuses and everything that's involved with that. And I don't know, I like history, and I was looking at that. But after reading the syllabuses, the outlines of the courses that you have to take, and after looking at job titles and all that, or job opportunities, I didn't like that course at all. And so my father, he's a tradesman. And so I always had tools around, and I always had like little projects going. And, you know, looking at things, I decided I wanted to be a tradesman instead. And mostly because I could run my own business, I could be self-employed. And so once I decided I wanted to be a tradesman, my dad does stuff like construction, you know, house stuff. And I always went to work with him. But, you know, frankly, I don't like that sort of work, because it's like half your time is spent, at least in like Toronto, like half your time is spent driving, picking stuff up, talking to clients, and very little spent working. And like, even working, half your time is moving materials from the car or from the van, from the truck inside, moving tools inside, moving tools outside. And then you're working around, like, you know, in private people's houses. And I just didn't like it at all. So I decided I wanted to work in a workshop, like something I could have my own, you know, space. And, you know, I liked wood. I was looking at cabinet making, whatever. I decided on welding because I don't know exactly, but something just about metal I liked better. And so I decided to go to school for welding because, I mean, I had an interest in blacksmithing since I was like 13, and I saw videos on YouTube. But I decided to go into welding because I didn't think you could like make a living in blacksmithing. But somehow, you know, I kept doing more research, and I found people who were making a living doing it. And so I kind of, you know, I looked at what they were doing, and I wanted to do what they were doing. And my idea then was more sort of ornamental iron work, because I thought, okay, maybe you can't make a living forging, but you can put elements, you can put forged elements into gates and railings and whatever else.
In the way I was thinking, bud.
Yeah. And so I thought to go that way, but then, you know, it's not that I don't like that sort of work, like it's fine, whatever, but you also have, you know, you have the issue of, you know, clients, and it's a real headache, like, you know, because those high-end railing jobs, it's good money, but you're dealing with, you know, you can make a lot of money, you can lose a lot of money all at once, right? Like it's
big time,
sir. You're nailing it.
And so I really like the course I took with the tool making, and I mean it's nice and it allows me a lot of freedom, and I'm not really beholden to like one client who gives me one job that's going to last 3 months, and then something doesn't work out, and you know, you don't get paid, or you have to put, you know, lawyers and whatever. It's
There you go.
God, a nightmare, man. So, the nightmare.
Pretty much, you had a passion for business before you had a passion for blacksmithing.
Well, not quite business, because it's all kind of, I mean, even what I do now, it's not really, I'm self-employed. I'm not a businessman, right?
That's a businessman.
I mean, it's all me, right? I don't know. When I think of a business, I think of, you know, like managers and, you know, production and secretaries and, you know, regimented things. I have to do everything, right? Like marketing. Mm-hmm. Production, yeah. Cleaning, everything, maintenance, machine building, everything.
This is a conversation that has been very prevalent in my household lately. My wife and I have been discussing, what the possibilities of me doing what I'm doing would as a full-time business. You know, if I decide that this is what I want to do, well, that's all me. And then what? And she already runs her own business. She's got employees under her belt for her house cleaning business. And, you know, throughout the discussion, I said to her, you know, there's for years now, I have felt like if I was to help her with her business and she was to help me with my business and we worked together, we could easily run two businesses and be okay with each other and be happy. And everything changes so much when you have somebody else working with you towards the business end of it, dude.
You know, very often, like you see this in certain companies, like let's say HVAC, you know, plumbing, what electrical, whatever. Like once, let's say the owner, if he marries and his wife starts helping him with like the administrative stuff, because let's face it, you know, a lot of men, like they get in it, they have employees, but the paperwork is just such a headache and like, you're behind or it's not done right or this or that. It always kind of slows you down or it's always hanging.
It's always a hindrance. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But once somebody's helping you with that, like it's taken care of, then you can just focus on what you're doing, like managing your crew, and somebody else handles all that paperwork and it just makes everything so much easier. Like I can, you know, it makes it so much easier to expand. Like somebody even just answering the phone, right? Like if you don't answer half your phone calls, you can be losing half your work. If you have someone answering the phone all the time, then
my wife's rebuttal on it was that it'll work, the possibilities of things going better in that aspect of us working together are there, but there's also the possibilities that it could very well lead to our divorce as well, right? So it's kind of like this toss up, and it's like, yeah, I understand where you're coming from, but at the same time, like the benefit of having somebody working with you that you know you can fully trust that they're not going to screw around, and that their interests are fully vested in the business, that their interests aren't in them promoting themselves to become a better person necessarily so that they can, you know, come in and get the fuck out and go do something else somewhere else. That no, that this is my life. This is what we're doing, hon. Like I'm here with you for the rest of life, 100%. Everything we do, we have to do it as best as we can do it because this is us. This is all we got.
Yeah. Well, when you trust people, it's easier to make moves.
100%.
Invest.
I think if you're working together for the same goal, you're not going to be, you know, shoulder to shoulder. She's not going to be the shop. You're not going to be doing the marketing and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, you're both working for that same goal. But how is that going to lead to a divorce, really?
Well, we're both very headstrong people that, you know, you butt heads over an idea of like, well, you know, we should purchase this equipment for the shop. No, you can't purchase that equipment for the shop. We need to put winter tires on the employee vehicle or something like that. Like, which one's more important, Lyndon, right? Like, come on, pull your head out of your ass. Yeah, you're right. You know, winter tires are more important. And, you know.
Well, that all depends. And those things are minor and petty. I mean, you know, we're talking when it gets to the point where that's going to be minor stuff, buddy.
Honestly. Oh, fuck. It's fucked up how all the minor things can add up to being one big problem, though, really, dude. You know, you get enough small problems and, you know, over time they pick away at you. I'm fucking describing something else here right now. let's not talk about that. Do you have any foresight to ever work with your wife, Paul, or where you guys at on that?
Well, I'm not married, so.
Oh, sorry. No. Are you guys engaged or just?
No, I'm no.
Are you single, dude?
Yeah.
Ladies, you hear this? There's a good looking, hardworking man.
What is this? Forge-side candle, like matchmaking thing now? Is this like forge-side dating?
It was Valentine's Day yesterday.
Yeah, there you go.
This isn't the Hustle and Grinder podcast.
So, oh my God. So do you have somebody that is helping you with the books, helping you with marketing, helping you, you know, carry your business further?
I do it myself. Like, you know, I have an accountant, but, you know, like one of the reasons, I mean, I don't have like employees and, you know, a ton of overhead. Basically it's pretty simple. Let's say my bills. So I just, you know, I just pay what I have to, and that's right. How, you know, that's how it works. I do what my accountant says as far as the, you know, like tax stuff and.
Right.
Yeah.
So you moved from Toronto, your 350 square foot shop, the little tiny thing to St. Catharines next, correct?
Yeah. So that happened back in like 2016 and, you know, the reason I moved to St. Catharines, so I was able to find a nice space there. So I moved out there and that was nearly 2,000 square feet. So that, you know, nice. Was a huge difference then. Mm-hmm. And I like that shop, but, you know, like there's always problems with forging. Forging's a huge problem. Like if you're actually running hammers, like if you're running a press, it's not a problem. If you're a welder, it's not a problem. But if you're running hammers, like you can, you know, start taking people off pretty quick. Mm-hmm. So you have to be careful with that. It also depends on the area. Like sometimes, you know, there are some areas where every single shop is like, you know, a mechanic shop, a welding shop, a whatever, and mm-hmm. everybody's making a ton of noise and nobody really cares. But anyway, like where I was kind of limited in, like, and I really lamented it the entire time, but I was limited in how much I could work. I was mostly forging in the evenings and doing all my other stuff during the day because I just didn't want to bother my neighbors because a lot of people just had warehouses. So mm-hmm. I didn't want to tick them off with like, you know, 220 beats per minute, boom, 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 constantly with the power hammers. But I moved out of there recently and I'm setting up the new shop and everything. I haven't been able to actually start working here yet, but because the new shop requires a ton of work, like just everything has to be redone. But I'm excited here because I think I can really expand. I think it's going to be huge, like as far as the scope of my work, how more I can do.
Right on. So you do you have any employees, or you're the one man show?
Just me. Like I had somebody for 6 months, and I mean they helped me a bit with the forging stuff, but it was really kind of a side thing that they were doing. Right. I had that for 6 months. Like it was good, but. And, you know, it was good. I kind of regret it, but, you know, I had to, anyway, like it, you know, I had him for 6 months. I kept him for 6 months and then I went back to working, you know, by myself. Good people are hard to find and that's why I kind of regret it. But it, like the way things were, it was kind of, you know, that's part of the problem. Like, if I could run a hammer all the time, then I could keep him busy all the time. But
yeah,
I had a job and he did it. And then, you know, I kind of, it was hard to keep him occupied basically after that. But yeah, like over here, you know, I'm going to have more, more opportunities. So we'll see how that goes.
Oddly enough, this was also part of the conversation I had with my wife, was employees and how in the blacksmithing world, there's kind of a few different ways that you can go about it. You can have a business like what Nick has, where you're essentially setting up a constant style of business that you know you need to have a certain amount of people on deck for the task at hand, and that task at hand is going to be the same task day in, day out. Yeah, whereas if you run a shop where you're doing artistical blacksmithing, making railings and gates or whatever it is, you can go through huge fluxes of work where you need to hire somebody, but you're only going to have them on for 6 months or a year while that project is hot and going, and then that project is done, and then it's like, okay, that was it. It's the next project isn't on the table yet. I've got small things, but I got no work for you, buddy. Sorry. And I know that exists because there's a few shops in the city that I've talked to, and they've offered me that style of work, and I've almost jumped on it because that opportunity to work for a few months under the table, making a couple extra bucks or whatever type thing, and the education you gain from it can be extremely beneficial.
Yeah,
but for sure, to walk away from essentially a job that is, you know, a lifelong career for something that's going to last a few months is way too dicey for me to ever take on or whatever, right?
Yeah.
There's other guys out there that's the lifestyle they live. They jump from job to job like that, from city to city even, you know. You'll get a guy that goes from Edmonton to Toronto for work because he found work there for 6 months, right?
Yeah, and, you know, I spent some time in Europe, and that's, you know, the journeyman system is still going strong there. And so it's not uncommon for somebody to do exactly what you said. Like, they spend 2 months here, 3 months there, 6 months there, a year there, and they just jump around, like, you know, from the Czech Republic to Germany to Italy to France, and they're just all over. It's kind of, you know, it's kind of a nomad lifestyle, so it takes a certain personality, but you know, time in your life. But I mean, some guys end up doing it all their lives, but you know, eventually, if you want to settle down and do your own thing, then it's difficult. But a lot of people, you know, the experience you gain there is immense, because you're spending time in experienced people shops who get, you know, good work, and they put out good work, and they get good jobs. So, you know, you'll do that six times, and pretty much, you know, after you work for a few years like that, you're set to go on your own.
What's that like going to Europe? Because, I mean, I think that the level of craftsmanship and the amount of blacksmiths in Europe and farriers and everything else, anyone who works with metal in Europe is just next level. So
it's interesting because the tradition, it didn't die in Europe. Like, it all lasted decades longer, and you know, their whole training system is, or depends on the country, like, it was a lot stronger. And the tradition is a lot stronger. Like, people take a lot of pride in what they do. So I mean, it's definitely really, like, interesting, because I was in Germany a little bit. Last year, I spent like the first half of the year basically in Poland, and I was working on, I got my journeyman certification in Poland there, like blacksmith journeyman. So I spent, and also, like, in 2019, I was invited by Peter Brunner to his hammer in.
Nice.
And like, we met the summer before he came to Canada. So I hosted him for a week, and he invited me there to do, like, I did a demonstration, a class there
at the Hammer Inn. Congratulations on all that.
That's awesome.
The journeyman. Yeah, man, that's awesome. Good for you.
Thank you. But while there, like, you know, I was talking to various people, blacksmiths, and it's interesting because it's a different mentality, and you know, just the designs, like everything, it's all very interesting to me. Like, you know, mm-hmm. also like in Russia, for example, they just looking at their work, they work totally different. Like their style is different than what you find in, you know, like in Germany or what they produce in Italy or in England.
Yeah.
So there's just so much variation and so many experienced people who make beautiful work. It's really interesting to see.
Yeah, it's hard as an artist blacksmith in Canada to actually look at a lot of that stuff and not feel as though you're just a freaking hack.
Yeah, no, it's crazy. Like, it's to me, it's insane. Like, what stands out to me, like the work that really stands out, is like, I don't know if you see this, but on Instagram, there's also quite a few good YouTube channels, like Russian blacksmiths, and I met a few here in like Toronto, who are in the surrounding areas. There's a few Russian blacksmith shops, and they have to go through like industrial training. They're not just like artist blacksmiths, but like industrial. So they can work extremely efficiently. They set up jigs. They have tooling, punch presses. I visited one who, well, I saw a shop. Unfortunately, he died, but his son-in-law was selling everything out. And he had eight sections of railing on the wall. And his clients could pick one and, like, you know, some variation. And he had tooling set up for everything. All the scrolls for this, all the leaf dies for this, mm-hmm. everything. And the client just picked out what they liked. And we changed this element, changed this element, changed that element. And he just produced it. Like, it's full production.
That's crazy.
Like, yeah. You know, it's not like a lot of people do. They make a special design for everything, and it's hard to be efficient that way. But the way he did it, like, it's just, I mean, to me, it was incredible to see. And unfortunately, the man died. He was only like 52, but he had an accident, whatever. But, you know, there's a few shops like that. And they make really nice work. And you know, it's, you can always compare yourself, but you know, at the end of the day, like, everybody kind of, they work their own way, and everybody's clients demand something different. So,
you know, even in that Toronto area, there is a massive amount of artistic talent and a lot of blacksmiths and metal workers.
Yeah.
Do you get to talk and pick their brains quite often, or?
No, you know, unfortunately not, but it's, I don't know, sometimes you meet people like here or there, and I did meet one, and I forget his name, but he does really nice work. He works sometimes with Oleg Shishkin, who has, I think his is like the kind of, it's called like wrought iron art or something like that, the website, and he does a lot of really, really high-end work in Ontario. And the man I met, unfortunately, I forget his name. He pretty much kind of, he's like a foreman, you know, it's all like, from what I see, has, you know, there's always like in every shop, like people come through all the time, but this man, he was kind of like a stable employee who kind of, you know, he oversaw everything and kind of did most of the,
like the foreman kind of,
like the head blacksmith basically.
Yeah,
so he knew all the tooling, all the jigs, and he could direct people, you know. But you know, that's one man I met, and I saw his shop too, and he had a nice setup. But you know, I don't really focus on railings or that sort of stuff, so I don't know too many people.
Have you crossed paths with Jaco van Bruenhorst at all?
Yes, I have. I met him last year.
You guys strike me as two young people that would work like fucking so good together. I bet you got the same mentality, man. The two of you guys.
Yeah, no, I like Jaco. Like, I saw his stuff, and then he we met, like I was selling something. I don't even remember what it was exactly, but we met and talked. And yeah, no, I like his work and I like seeing his updates on Facebook, like, you know, notifications come up. So I like seeing that. Like, I know. Yeah.
I know he's, his background is Dutch. Do you mind me asking what your background is?
Polish.
You're Polish. That's henceforth why you went back to Poland then.
Yeah. That's why I spent the,
got to spend time with your family there, or?
Yeah. I visited family and that was nice. And, you know, it worked out well because the city my grandparents are in, that's where, how do I put this? It's the Polish, blacksmith organization, basically, like the Fellowship of Blacksmiths.
Oh, nice.
Right. That's cool.
The president is there and his shop is only like, I don't know, 15 kilometers from my grandparents' place.
Nice. Oh, really?
Yeah, that was really nice. Be able to go there. I didn't have to travel halfway across the country or whatever. It was all right.
Yeah. There. Very cool.
I want to bring something up and I'm a little bit worried as to how it's going to come across to yourself, because you being a sole operator for your business, it's somewhat the same aspect that I would be looking at if I was to decide to go into business as well. And I know another gentleman in the circle of Canadian blacksmiths recently fell into this debacle. What happens if you get hurt and you can't work, dude?
Well, you have to make enough money in the good times to last you through the bad times. That's how I think of it. But you have to be careful. Yeah. I mean, you know, you can't do stupid stuff. Like, you have to be careful. Don't take risks. Don't put your hands where you don't want them to be crushed. You know, don't change tooling under the power hammer with your hands. You know, weld handles onto it or use tongs. You know, get good at making tongs and use good tongs. You know, it's kind of, you know, everybody knows more or less when they're putting themselves in a risky situation, and you just have to minimalize that, right? Like, just don't put your hand there. If it can get crushed, don't stand in pinch points. You know, you have to have forethought, right?
Give up snowboarding and skateboarding.
Yeah. You know, you have to be careful. You know, skiing's fun, but you know, you hit a tree and you're up for 2 months. Well, that's going to,
your business is done. Yeah.
Hitting that tree is going to hurt.
Not necessarily. But you're going to be down to like 20% capacity, right?
Yeah.
Without your leg. Without your arm, then it's a lot worse.
Yeah.
Yep.
100%.
You just got to be careful.
This is a discussion that I've been having with that's honestly my wife's biggest worry. She would probably totally be 100% on my side if I had a solid answer to that. And there's just, we have to be straight up. There isn't anything you can do about it. So what kind of, what kind of margin do you look at as to what do you think is a smart amount to have put aside for a maybe situation? Well, I guess it's all different for everybody, right? You know,
yeah,
it depends
like
on
as much as possible, but like as much as possible. Like, but it's, I know that it's kind of a answer that's up in the air, but
yeah, like, do you look at your income and decide from every job I'm going to put 5% of my income aside for savings? Or,
well, honestly, like I don't spend much money, like, so, you know, I don't. It's not like
so it
I
just
have,
all,
you know,
all goes to savings. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you know, I don't have a wife and kids that, like, you know, I constantly have expenses going. It's,
that's it, buddy. Yeah, that's it, man.
I have to pay, you know, my bills and I don't know. Aside from that, like,
belly.
I don't go out buying. Yeah. I don't have to go out and buy new clothes all the time. You know, you got to buy fuel. You have to buy your electricity, pay your taxes, whatever. And aside from that, you know, you kind of have to be ahead of it, right? Like, you have to have, you know, it's business. You have to have more money coming in than it's going out.
100%.
To to answer the question, like if you have an injury, how long does it take to recover? Like minimum 4 weeks if it's bad, right? Maybe 8 weeks, maybe 12 weeks, but having three months of expenses ahead of time, I think that's good. Like
that's a smart number, yeah.
Yeah.
I feel that,
buddy. It all adds up, right? But, you know, you're spending $5,000, having $15,000 reserve is, you know, it feels good. But even that can go
for sure, right? Oh, fuck yeah, right? Yeah. Exactly. You never know what the circumstances are going to be. What about when it comes to buying supplies for the shop? Do you find yourself buying in large bulk so that you do the buy once, cry once kind of deal? Or are you on a constant supply chain where you're bringing in supplies once a week or something like that? How do you manage that?
I buy once, cry once. Like I don't like going online all the time and putting in all my information and ordering stuff and then remembering that it's coming in and then you buy like two of it. Like it's not, yeah. For me, that's a hassle. Like grinding belts, I get like a year ahead, you know, like I just buy it for the whole year.
Hey, wait a minute. Grinding belts. Do you know that you can head over to maritimeknifesupply.ca, buy 10 belts and you'll get one for free? You can't beat it, man. Probably the best deal you'll find out there. And we can also save you guys $100 if you use the code FSCKILN on checkout. If you're buying yourself an Even Heat or a Paragon Kiln, use that code FSCKILN. Save yourself $100. Thank me later.
Excellent.
Yep. Yeah, so that's good to know.
So just out of curiosity, what do you use for grinding belts?
You might edit this part out, but there's Hermes Abrasives in Mississauga. And so I order from them because I just pick up from them and it's all, you know, it's all close.
I was talking local, to you. Buddy. Are you more? Yeah, that's local. I mean, do you, is it VSM? Is it Norton? Is it Klingspor? What's your go-to
Hermes.
Grinding belt? Hermes.
Really? Hermes. H-E-R-M-E-S.
Right on.
It's a ceramic abrasive. You know, I don't really use other ones. They're just close and they're not that expensive. Like, last time I bought them was like a year ago, but maybe even 2 years ago because I bought a ton. But they're green abrasive, like it's a green ceramic abrasive.
Wow.
It lasts okay.
And they're produced right there.
The belt itself is made in Germany, and I don't know if it's a German company, and I don't know if they splice them in Canada or if they order them from Germany, but I think they order them in Germany. I don't know exactly how it works, but
actually
they last
most
okay.
Of,
and
yeah.
The I buy 24 grit. Like I don't play around. Like I don't like
24 grit.
Ooh, gnarly.
Whoa, 24 grit.
Yeah. Like, you know, I don't like playing around. Like if I have to remove material, I want to remove it. I don't want to stand in front of it and stare at it, whatever. It's got to work. So, you know, my grinder is bolted down. My stand is bolted down and I press as hard as I can.
what are you running for a grinder, bud?
I have a 2 horsepower. It has a VFD 2x72.
Wait, and you make your own grinders, don't you?
Yeah, I make them as well.
Whoa.
I've been using that one. And I have a Northern tool grinder. Like I bought that in 2016 and it works great. And I just, you know, it has a VFD, it has everything installed. So I just keep running that. Yeah. My grinders, I have auxiliary. So if I want like something else, you know, I want to do something else with it. Like I set it up. I didn't have the space. Like I had one for wood, but I didn't have the space to set up like a bench of grinders. And I didn't want I don't like keeping multiples of things because it just kind of gets in your way. Like I don't need 2 anvils because one does the job. 2 drill presses, whatever.
Take that back right now.
No, because you have to be efficient with your space. Like it's nice to have 10 of things, but at the end, you're just going to end up walking longer and cleaning around more things. And it just takes up, you need twice as much space if you have twice the number. And unless it's something like a power hammer where you're trying to save heats going between like 3 things, then it just
anybody
doesn't make sense.
Anybody want to buy a couple anvils? Anybody want to buy a couple vices?
Because we've got to get rid of
stuff.
I kept one anvil on my floor in my old shop. Like that's what I worked on. That's where I used.
Yeah.
Oh, tell me about your tool. I mean, tools.
Yeah.
What anvil? What did you have for an anvil? What was your anvil, bud?
I made an anvil when I was in shop class in high school. nice. And I've been using that one since. Like I made
no
it.
Way. Holy.
Let me to stand and. I have a video on YouTube on how I made it.
How big of an anvil is it?
It's 115 pounds. So
wow.
There was a bunch of scrap material. Like it was 1.5 by 4 square bar or a rectangular bar, solid, at the shop in high school. It was a manufacturing class. And, you know, they have these set projects, but in grade 12, I asked the teacher if I can make something out of that, you know, material. Because I read a bunch of stuff on Anvil Fire or anvilfire.com, I think it is. That was mm-hmm. like a good resource like 10 years ago. Like there wasn't too much on the internet about blacksmithing.
No. So
there was some really good stuff there about building your own power hammer, actually, building your own anvil.
I bought Jim Batson's book off of Anvil Fire on Forge Press Making. So, and that's.
I probably bought it off there too. Like
Yeah.
I got that. I have that book, but I got it through Randy McDaniel's website.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
Well, I think I found it through there. Maybe it was iForge Iron or something, but, you know.
Yeah.
I did end up buying that book too. But the anvil, you know, it was mild steel. It was 14 inches high, so it's pretty. Right. I said it's not going to be too heavy, but I'm going to have a lot of steel under the hammer, and it's going to be real good.
Yeah.
And I bought a plate of 4140, and I did a full penetration weld. Like, I finished it the last day of school, like, the last day of high school. Like, I grounded at home and heat treated at home.
Right on.
Well, you heat treated it too.
Yeah. Like, I put it, I did it in my Coke Forge, and it was no problem. Like, it actually came out really nice. Like, it's hard. It's really hard.
That's awesome. Up,
like, dude.
I filled up like 10 garbage bins with water, like halfway, so we could actually lift it.
Yeah.
But, you know, we lifted the anvil, we put it on the ground. I put a sawhorse close to it so we could tip the garbage can with water instead of just, you know, trying to hold it. Because I knew we couldn't do that.
So you water quenched it?
Yeah, water quenched 4140.
Waterfall.
Exactly. And I knew we needed a waterfall. I wasn't just going to like throw it in something or put a hose on it because I wanted it to get hard.
Yeah.
We pulled it out and I wanted to record it and I forgot the camera. And so I ran home like real quick. I pulled it out. Then it still came out like perfect. Like it's hard. It dents if you miss a strike like really hard, but it's a very small dent and it's, you know, it's been working great. I've been using it for 8 years. The only thing I regret is I made it 3 inches wide and I wish it was like at least 3.5, 3.75.
Yeah.
But, you know, I got used to it. Like, my hammer kept falling off, but now I'm used to it, and that happens less.
There you go.
Yeah, the video's online. Like, it's if you search my name or Toronto Blacksmith or my first name in the first 5 characters, my last name, so PaulKrzy, as said, anvil making, it'll pop up.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. Very cool.
On YouTube?
Yeah, YouTube.
And if people want to find you on Instagram, it's Paul Kruskowski.
Toronto _ blacksmith. If you search my name, that will come up too.
Yeah, that's how I found you. Yeah.
So that's the anvil there.
And you must have a hydraulic press.
Yeah. So, well, I built myself 2 presses. I built one back in that old shop, 2015, and I used it exclusively for punching. And it worked great. Like I didn't ever change it. Like I made one jig and it was like perfect. And I built a second one in 2018. The first one was a small C-frame press and it was only like 8 tons, but it was quick. That was a good one. And then I made another one in 2018, much larger with a like 10 horse motor. I don't know. It was going like 3 or 4 inches per second, something like that.
Whoa. Yeah.
And it had, if you can imagine, there's basically 4 hydraulic cylinders. In the center, there's 2 with a 24 inch bed. And on the sides, on either side, there's 1 with like a small, basically like a C-frame press. So, and it has three independent foot pedals. So I can work efficiently. Like, you set up tools in there and you don't have to constantly change stuff.
So, okay, maybe it wasn't a dream that I had then. I've had this concept in my head for 5 years now, probably about 5 years, of building a large H-frame press that you can do stuff on the center bed. Mine's 32 inches wide on the center bed, and then have a C-frame off of one end of it. I didn't go with both ends. I was just going to go with one end, but the exact same idea. All ran off of the same motor, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, but, you know, if you can also just build a C-frame with a ram on either side. That's good too.
Or
you could just build like a bunch of compact presses, like put them on a table and hook it up with, like, let's say you have a three or four or five spool valve, and you put quick connects on it. Because right now, I like the press, it works well, but I'm just thinking, like, I want a horizontal press. And I'm going to have to put quick connects on things and disconnect things now. Whereas if I put like a four spool valve on it, I could have a dedicated fourth auxiliary setup. So I just hook up the quick connect hoses to whatever, you know, press I want.
What would be the benefit of a horizontal?
If you're doing a lot of bending.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You want a horizontal press. You don't want to, you know, you can, if it's a small part, you can do it on a vertical press. But if it's a large part, you want a horizontal press.
Right.
Because it's, you're going to be limited with what you can put under there.
Right.
And so the horizontal press is better for that.
I was looking at going with ball valves to be able to swap between the systems.
I don't know about hydraulic ball valves. Maybe they make them, and I think that would be good. But, you know, if you have quick connects on one side or somewhere, then it's you know, just a hydraulic quick connect. You just swap.
Yeah, that's how I've got it right now. I've got quick connects on my hoses, so I can swap from one to another if I wanted to. I don't have another to swap to right now, but if I did, I could.
Yeah. I mean, you can also just, you know, look online and try to find like an auxiliary, like a secondary hydraulic power pack.
Yeah, that's another option. Just have another hydraulic pack for sure is another option. Yeah. But
you know, it's better to run everything off. I mean, if you can, one pack, because again, you're saving space. Like, there's no reason to have like 10 of everything unless you have a job that you need. You need so many.
Yeah, as long as the hydraulic pack is powerful enough that it can handle the continuous cycling.
Yeah.
Right. That's one of the things that I've actually found with my power pack is that I can't remember how many cycles it was, but we were just given her, and the breaker on the machine itself popped, and it was like, whoa, what the hell? Yeah. I guess we pushed the machine past its limits. Yeah, for the motor.
Well, that happens sometimes. Like, I did that to a drill press once, like drilling aluminum. It just kept like getting stuck, and so it overheated.
Yeah,
that's, I don't know. Like, you can put a fan on it, and, you know, it's in the summer. The shop gets hot. Everything's hot. The motor.
That's the problem right there.
Above 40 degrees.
Yep.
So, yeah, like, you can, you know, you can always buy a more expensive, you know, motor, a larger motor, and it will probably handle it no problem next time.
Exactly. And then what are you running for power hammers?
Well, right now, before I went to Poland, like, I sold some stuff, and I sold my Sahinler and I sold my Little Giant, which I kind of regret, because the Little Giant was really nice, hard-hitting, wide dies. It was like, beautiful. And I got it. The thing was almost unused when I bought it.
No way.
It was used near, I actually bought it in London, Ontario, and it was used in an automotive factory for a cold bending leaf springs based on the dies that were there. But the thing was, like, it was mint, like, super tight, like one of the last ones made 1977 or 78.
Okay. Oh, anyway,
unfortunately, I sold it. And then I had a Sahinler 60 kg, and that was also a beautiful hammer, like super, like, it was powerful. It was responsive. It had great control. sold that too. But
did you sell that to Nick Verbrugge?
Not sure. You know, I wasn't here at the time. My dad was. My dad handled that. But it was like, I don't know. I'm going to be lamenting that for a long time. But
well, yeah.
I ended up picking up two hambers when I was in Poland, like a 60 kg and 100 kg.
Oh, nice.
And so, nice. Yeah, and those are full industrial hammers. Like they weigh three times as much as the Sahinle. Like the one, the 60 weighs twice as much and the 100 weighs like three times as much. And like those hammers are going to be, I know they're going to be killer for me.
What brand are they?
They were made during the Polish People's Republic, like during communist times. And so they're just like from what I can see from my research, the Western Pact country or the Warsaw Pact countries, everything outside of the Soviet Union and the the Soviet sphere of influence, they had like one kind of hammer design, basically. And so, you know, they made the same hammers in Poland as they did in, I don't know about East Germany, but the same in Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, Romania.
So it'd be all state companies that were making hammers, I would imagine. Eh?
Yeah, for sure. Right. So, you know, they didn't skimp on material. Like it's,
yeah.
Yeah.
The anvils, they have a proper 1 to 10 or 1 to 12 hammer to anvil ratio.
Oh.
So they're really nice. I just got to get it running.
What's it like getting a hammer out of Europe?
Man, Europe, everything in Europe is like 10 times more complicated than it is here.
Yeah.
So much paperwork and bureaucracy and it's such a headache. Like I had agents handle it for me because I was looking into it and I just said, you know what? I don't want to deal with this. Like it's like so many forms and yeah, it's just, I had somebody else handle it for me.
Well, and they know what they're doing.
Yeah, they'll get the paperwork right the first time, and so you don't have to go like back and forth 20 times. Right.
Buy once, cry once.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Tell me about your hand hammers. Nick Verbrugge's question coming at you right there, bud. Old Soldier Toolworks, he's always got to know, what is your go-to favorite hand hammer?
It's kind of hard to say. Like I do a lot of straightening on my, like I do most of my hand work is like hammer anvil work is straightening axes. Like once I forge them, you know, touch it up here, there, or, you know, drive a drift or do this. So when I'm driving drifts, I made a 6-pound sledge, a soft sledge out of 4340. And I have it somewhere on my Instagram page. You can see it, but I've made them out of 1045 and they don't last that long. Like 1045 isn't good for soft tools. It mushrooms over quickly and it cracks. It'll crack cold or soft when it's soft. Yeah.
Really?
4140, it'll almost, you'll never see cracks there. Like, you know, cracks start to form. And then I made one out of 4340 and 4340 is a weight. It's even tougher than 4140. Like it's incredible.
Yeah.
I've had this 6-pounder for, I don't know, like 3 years, 4 years. And I have it, like, I like long handles on my hammers. Mm-hmm. Like some people put like clubby, I don't know, like 10-pound, like Mason's hammers. I don't like those hammers. I put like 16-inch, 18-inch handles on and I like the way they feel.
Yeah. You like a long handle for sure.
Yeah. Especially on like a drifting hammer. Like you need, I don't like the club hammers. Don't like them at all. Like, you know, those Czech style, whatever. I might be offending some people, but
no, by all means, that's personally what I would prefer to use as a drifting hammer. And you're not offending me, dude.
Yeah. So
you're using more leverage, right? With the longer handle. So it's going to drift better.
Even with the long handle, I still hold it like halfway, but just having that extra bit on the end, like it feels better. Mm-hmm. Like with the balance.
Yeah.
But that's what I use for driving drifts. And that's a lot of my hand work. And then for straightening, I have a 3.5-pound rounding hammer and a 2.2-pound rounding hammer, which I made. I took a class at Brian Brazil's in 2013 for a week.
Ooh, buddy, for a week. Oh, yeah, dude.
We worked like 12 hours a day. Like it was, I counted 82 hours at the time.
Don't you work like 16-hour days normally anyways?
I don't know. Like nowadays I try not to, because like, I don't know, you get tired and, you know, it's better to kind of keep it more normal. But when I took that class, I was actually working with Alex Steele. And so the first thing I made, or the first hammer we made, I struck for that 2.2-pound rounding hammer, or it's like a 2-pound rounding hammer, something like that. And I really like that one for straightening, because it's just heavy enough to kind of move something a little bit. Like I wouldn't forge stuff with it really, it's just for straightening. And then the 3.5-pounder, I use that one sometimes, just depends on the feeling. And I also have a hammer by Jacob Farum. I traded with him for something, for an axe. And it's a really nice hammer. And I use that one for straightening sometimes too. It's a straight peen he made. A straight peen, but more kind of like a fuller, a heavy fuller on the back, like 2-inch, than a peen. But I like that one for straightening because it's very crowned. Base is very crowned.
See, Nick, you brought something up before with me. Actually, it was pre-discussion before the podcast about what you said before. You know, you don't really want to make hammers because people started asking you for hammers. So you kind of decided to stray away from that because you had people interested in your hammers. So you're kind of shooting yourself in the foot. And it's like, the side to that you're not seeing that we didn't speak about is I'm not making hammers that are nearly close to what Paul's work is, Ferrum's work is, freaking hoops. I'm not freaking falling into line with these guys, man. And until I do, I'm like, do I want to be giving these hammers to people? Like, really?
Dude, you know what? It's all subjective. And I mean, not every hammer is the same, but at the same time, you know,
she said,
yes, indeed. happy Valentine's Day. you're making these hammers and, you know, you're doing a good job. And the hammer that you make today isn't going to be the same hammer that you're going to make in a month or 2 months or 3 months or a year. I mean, but you got to keep banging out hammers. And what are you going to do with all those hammers? You got to sell them. Otherwise, you're just going to have a shop full of hammers.
Yeah, it's getting that way.
Yeah.
Well, you have to practice, and you know everybody has different standards, but you have to practice until you make something you're happy with, you're happy to sell, you're happy to take money for it. Like, you're not ashamed.
That's exactly it. You're hitting it on the head, buddy, right there. I do not want to. I hate the idea of being ashamed of my work. That is the thing that is holding me back the most.
That's the great thing about blacksmithing is if you're ashamed of it, heat it up and, you know, do it again.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting though, like the standards today are kind of totally different because, you know, looking at old work in Europe, like if you look at medieval work or Renaissance work, like in cathedrals and churches and like cellars and, you know, everything is so crooked and so not perfect and cracked and just like broken lines. And you kind of look at it and be like, okay, nobody would be satisfied with that today. But back then that was kind of the standard. And, you know, there's still a tradition in Europe of tool making, like all these small tool making shops, they still exist, a lot of them. And when I was in Poland, like there were some shops that they still make axes, like not many. There's like two or three I know of where it's a family tradition. And one just stopped in the last year, unfortunately. But their work, like, it's not like the beautiful stuff that kind of, you know, you have to kind of make nowadays as a blacksmith here in North America. Their stuff is utilitarian. Like, the prices are still, it's not like a hardware store axe. Like, let's say a hardware store axe over here is $40. They might charge $80 for the same axe. So it's not like crazy expensive. It's more expensive. Somebody wants something nicer, they'll buy it. But it's not perfect. It's utilitarian. It's a regional style. People like it. Yeah. But it's ground to like 120 grit, even 80 grit. The fit is rough on the handle. But, you know, people buy them. People like them. People use them. And and they work well. It's not that they don't work. It's just they don't put a super high polish on it. They don't sand the handle beautifully. It's a utilitarian thing, and it's not expensive, so people are happy to buy and happy to use it and use it up. You know, you buy more.
Yeah.
So you're saying I've got a chance.
Yeah, always a chance. You know, like a lot of people handicap themselves, and it is kind of hard to find a balance, but you have to, like, you just have to find a market and serve it. Like, if you want to do luxury stuff, expensive stuff, you have to do it, and you have to do it well. But, you know, there's also utilitarian market. It's, you know, like, go to the store and look at the fit and finish of the tools there, and people buy them every single day.
Oh, yeah. You know? Yeah.
So you just have to find a balance.
True. I am my own worst enemy, man.
If you just slap a Milwaukee sticker on it, you can charge double. So, yeah.
I say it's for the buys, and you're good to go. You were talking about actually moving away from Toronto a few years ago. Was that your beginnings of moving to St. Catharines, or were you actually looking to leave the Toronto region at that point? Do you remember when that was?
That was 2016, and just because I wanted a bigger shop, and I didn't want to like pay premiums, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't have to be in the city. Like, you know, if you're making axes and you're shipping stuff or whatever, if you're shipping small stuff and that's your business, you don't have to be in a big city. You can be outside the city and, you know, find someplace cheap as long as you have your suppliers not too far away, you know. Yeah. As long as you can actually buy stuff, like you can still get gas or coke or steel or whatever.
Yeah, you don't have to be in the big city to find coke.
No.
Oh, so wait, thing, fuel.
Yeah.
Gosh.
Yeah. 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 Why do you prefer a coke forge over a gas forge?
Well, no, I use gas, and that's what I use, but I do like coke because I noticed with coke it's much easier to get a clean finish. Like, it's
100%,
when I was using a coke forge, like, there's almost no scaling, and it's just beautiful right off the camera. Whereas with gas forge, you have to be very meticulous in how you set it, mm-hmm. how long you keep your work in. You can't. I know some people, like, they load up the entire forge at once, and then they light the forge, and then, you know, by the time everything heats up, the first piece is in there. You know, you start with the first piece. By the time you get to the 20th piece, it's like glowing green, and you're losing your carbon, and it's all scaled up. Like,
yeah,
I don't know. There's some work you can get away with that, but you have to be careful. You have to really manage. I mean, you have to manage both forges.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No, you can't turn your back on either one of them, that's for sure.
No.
Well, the propane forge a little bit more so, I'd say, but...
Yeah, I mean, you're not gonna burn your steel away in a propane forge.
You can.
Well, you can, but, I mean...
I have.
Yeah, you can melt it. If you make your forge well enough, you can melt it. But if you leave it in too long, you get your scale builds up.
Oh, yeah.
You beat that in, and it looks bad. Like, there's some more nobody cares, right? It gets humbled and painted, and you don't see it. It doesn't make a difference. If you're making tools and you leave it in too long, then, you know, you have decarburization in it. That's not good.
No,
that's totally right. I agree. Yeah.
Totally agree. Knock off that scale before every process. Yeah.
You know, but I'm not going to crank up my gas forge and then turn around for a half hour. I mean,
that happens.
You know.
Yeah, but, you know, sometimes you have five pieces in there, you're working production style, and somebody phones you, and, you know, it's supposed to be a 30-second call and ends up being 5 minutes. And
yes, this is what I'm talking about right there. Yeah.
There you go.
Let's put something in the forge. Look at the phone. Oh, hey, notification. What's this notification all about? Oh, shit. This is, and you're into it for half an hour.
You have to plan ahead, right? Like, if you have to go to the washroom, you have to either, you know, go quick or pull all your work out, and then it throws you behind. You have to be careful with all that.
That's
or
for
even
sure,
just getting
man.
Water, you know, like keeping, like in the summer when it's super hot and you keep, you know, you have to drink water, and you run out, you have to go get it. By the time you get it, come back. You have to be careful with everything. have to plan ahead.
Definitely. Do you find that having a fan running, how does that affect your work? Like being in a fan, do you like to have your fan on you when you're at the anvil, or do you find that that is bothersome in the high heat seasons?
No, I in the summer I need it. Like it's without that, it's just the air is so stale and hot. Like I'm just like pouring sweat like crazy. If it's like, you know, 35 degrees out, and you have the forge running, it's in my shop, it got like 10 degrees hotter.
Oh yeah,
so 45 degrees.
Yeah.
So it's without the air moving, like it was impossible to work for more than like half an hour. You just got way too hot. You know, heartbeat going like crazy. So I always had like 3 fans running on me in the summer. If I had to get work done.
Yes, yeah, see,
I have something running on me.
I'll have 3 fans running as well. But the thing that I found, for whatever reason, having the fan blowing on me while I'm at the anvil bugged the living freaking heck out of me, man. For whatever reason, I don't know. It was just like pushing my sweat into my eye or something like that. I don't know what it was, but I can't have my fan blown on me.
I always keep it off my face because, you know, it's all the dust in the shop is getting blown right in your eyes. Like it's...
Yeah,
no, I can't stand that either. So I usually like to have it high, but at my pointing at my body instead of low. Just kind of either, you know, like on a table, so it's going straight at your body, or kind of higher up at an angle, so it's not going to actually, but not high enough that's going to be crazy.
The thing that I seem to find works the absolute best for me is a fan on the floor to try to suck up that heat off or off the cool off the floor and bring it up into the air.
Yeah.
You are you working on a cement floor, a dirt floor, or?
I always had cement floors, and I'm going to keep cement because it's just, you know, it's easier to keep clean. But when I'm actually working, I always put out rubber mats wherever I am. Like I try to never sleep on concrete. So by my welding bench, I have a dedicated, there's a rubber mat down there. And then I have these small, like, I don't know what they are, 3x3 rubber mats. I don't know. They were cheap when I bought them. And I have like 4, and I throw them out when I'm forging. Yeah. Or if I'm at the grinder, I have one there. Like I always have one at the grinder too. Because standing on concrete all day, like you feel it. And you
put the rubber down,
feel a lot better at the end of the day.
Sucks dropping a piece of steel on those rubber mats, but saves your back.
Yeah, well, you know, it only takes like 2 seconds to pick it up again. You know,
only takes 2 seconds for that thing to start billowing smoke out too, eh?
Yeah,
nasty ass smoke from those.
The ones I have are like perforated, so it's not like, you know, like a stall mat or something. They're perforated, like, you know, with the holes, and they're light.
That's what I get too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well. Because if you get the solid rubber mats and the dust just builds up on top of them, then you start getting mats covered in absolute crap, and it's not nice to walk on then at that point.
Well, they're also heavy, and like you don't want to move them or lift them. And the light ones are better because you pick them all up at the end of the day. It's easier to sweep. So
definitely makes it easier to sweep from what I found for sure. Just roll them up and move them out of the way and you're done. Don't even have to worry about picking them up and knocking off all the slag off of them. Paul looks like he's frozen up on me now.
Looks like an awkward silence. Well, this would be a good opportunity to talk about what's going on in your shop. What are you working on there, Lando?
Actually, you know, it would be a really good thing to talk about is the Tuller linseed oil. We did not bring them up during the last episode. I had to patch it in as like a afterthought because I'm a freaking hoser and I forgot to bring it up. The Tuller linseed oil, man. What can I say? Head over to
TullerLinseed.com.
Use the code ForgeChat10 to save yourself 10% on orders $50 or more. Yeah, the Lynn Shield. Can't say enough good things about the Lynn Shield. Absolutely love that new product.
Mm-hmm.
Always been a fan of the Flax Wax. Great stuff. adds a nice aroma. We're back in the hot seat now, though. We're recording. People are hearing all these beautiful things that we're saying. We talked about the Twiller linseed and how you can use the code ForgeChat10. Do you use any finishing oils in your shop? What are you using?
I use, you know, the burnt on oil finish, and that's pretty much it. Like that's what I do. Like I do coat it with linseed oil at the end, my tools.
Yeah.
That's kind of as a protective coating, you know, against rust.
So here we go. This is all we needed is for you to tell us that you're using linseed oil, because my man, if you're not using the Twiller linseed oil, what the fuck? The Twiller linseed is grown, produced, and packaged right here in Canada out of Saskatoon. He doesn't use any sort of extra dryers or anything like that in his stuff, so it's food safe. Great product. Can't say enough about Dawson and the stuff he's doing for the community. You could use the code ForgeChat10, save yourself 10% on orders $50 or more. And check out what he's got on his website, thetwillerlinseed.com. He's got a few different options, either double boiled, cold pressed. He's got a few products like Linshield, Flax Wax. It's a great product, man. All these
adres. Good to know there's a Canadian producer and supplier.
Trying to get him into Princess Auto, fuck.
Oh, that'd be cool.
And linseed oil's not just for blacksmithing. You can use it for all sorts of different metalworking, dude. And the guy's even got a
stone finish, concrete finish.
Yep. And he's even got a paint that he's started producing recently, a linseed paint.
So at this point, it might be obvious that we ran into some technical difficulties. Nick is there in the recording at this moment. I'm actually recording this after the recording, after the fact. Nick is there, but he's not there. And because he's not actually part of the recording, there's some segments in here that are missing some audio from his side of things that kind of messed up the conversation a little bit that I'm trying to fill in for you guys to make more sense of what's missing. And at this point, we kind of dive into talking about how linseed rags and stuff like that shouldn't be left in the shop, as you'll hear right away.
Right.
Yep. Yep. Or you can saturate them and let them dry. Just don't throw a crumpled up rag in the trash because it will light. Yeah. I might have forgotten one time, but I won't confirm that. No. That's not why something moved.
I think
that would have made the news, but yeah.
What about just keeping them in a metal pail so that even if it did start fire, it would just burn in the metal pail and it's like whatever?
Yeah, but it's best if you have a lid on it. You can get a steel garbage can. Like Princess Auto had them on sale They always have them on sale, but you can get them, I think, normally for $30, like a steel garbage pan or a garbage bin, and it has a sealed lid. Like it seals really well. So, you know, I only have steel bins in my shop now. After I had, might have had a bad experience with plastic bins.
Oh, shit. How do you manage your scrap, Paul? What do you do as far as that goes?
I almost have no scrap, but I just keep it in buckets because, you know, I make tools. So my scrap is really like sawdust from swarf, saw swarf.
Yeah.
And then the metal shavings from grinding.
Yeah.
But from actual like work, it's just when I'm fabricating something, you know, I have pieces here and there. But you know, the recycler, last time I went, they even took my grinding swarf.
Like, oh yeah.
I didn't know that they would pay for that, but you know, they did.
Nice. Oh,
okay, that's almost shred price.
Almost what price?
Shred.
I thought you said shit price. I thought you were referring to manure. I didn't know manure was only worth $160 a ton.
No, it's always better than, you know, dumping it, right? So.
Oh, fuck yeah. To get taken over. I think that might be something that a lot of us blacksmiths overlook, is the fact that you can just take this metal into the scrapyard and get a little bit of extra coin for your, you know, your sawdust, your saw swarf, like you were saying, and shit, you could have other stuff mixed in there. They're not going to say nothing about it.
There's one tool maker who, if you have stuff mixed in, they'll give you shred price. Like, you have to... I mean, if you want to play with it, like anything over 1/4 inch, you can get, it's called like dealer melt or heavy melt. It's, you get, right now it's about 50% more than shred.
Really? Shred, like, they've never fucking offered me that.
Well, no, they don't, like they'll screw you over every chance they get. Like, you know, I took this wire in, like electrical wire, was cleaning some stuff up. Like there's a ton of stuff to clean in this property here. So I had electrical wire to take in, and I took it into one place, and they gave me 45 cents a pound as mixed wire. And I took all the ends off and everything, and I was kind of pissed off about that because, you know, number two insulated wire is like $2.50, number three wire is $1, and they gave me 45 cents for
it. Right, that's, yeah.
I mean, they screwed me over. For a bunch of brass, they gave me a bearing bronze, which is like 20 cents a pound, where it should be even like mixed brass.
$2. More like a dollar. Yeah.
Yeah, you have to be careful with what scrapyard you go to, and you have to know what you're doing, because then you can argue.
Yeah.
Yeah,
You ever deal with salvage yards, going into a salvage yard to find material?
Other than finding something at a scrapyard when I'm dumping something and putting it in my truck. No.
Wait, that doesn't happen.
No, I'm not saying I ever did that either. Just, you know,
I don't know of any
yards. It can happen. Like, you know, either way, you're leaving with more than you take out, so it's all the same. But I've only heard about that in stores. I don't know of any place that actually sells to the public. I heard it's all liability and whatever. Over the phone, nobody will tell me anything. Everybody says they don't do it.
You need to look for salvage.
Well, the only salvage places I've seen have been like auto salvage. So,
yeah. There's some places that deal with building material salvage, and they'll have stuff from bricks to steel to wood beams, you name it. They'll have all sorts of different building supplies.
Tell you, I've looked at those places, and I don't know, their prices seem kind of crazy to me. Like,
sheet
metal. They sell sheet metal for $1 a square foot, and you can get it new for $1.25 if you shop around. Right. So why am I going to buy stuff with holes in it that I have to repaint?
Holes and rusty.
Rusty, and like they throw it off the roof. Well, some people do, and they pay a premium for it, you know, if it's rusty. But, you know, they throw it off the roof, and it's all bent, and then they overpress it, and it's all kinked. And I don't understand how they make money, but people buy it, I guess, because they save it. But yeah, you can, you know, Well, you just, I don't know, it's experience. The first, when I started making axes, I made like 40, 50 that I threw. Had a bucket, and then I eventually scrapped them when I moved shelves, because I didn't want to take junk around with me.
40 or 50?
Yeah, just trying to figure things out, getting them the way I want them to be, to straighten them out, making them look nice.
He wouldn't sell them, he just threw them out.
Yeah, you know, well, knowing what I know now, I could have fixed a lot of them and sold them like as cheap utility axes. I should have done that.
But, don't put your finger at me.
But, you know, at the time, with the experience I had, I didn't want to keep carrying buckets of scrap with me, so I just tossed it. But as far as, like, fit and finish, it's just practice. Like, you have to know, and everybody does it differently. Like, it's like with grinding. You just have to learn how you want to stand, or how you stand at the anvil, how you look at it, how you... Everything matters. So how high your grinder is, Some people like the grinder real high. I hate it because it's all on your shoulders. I keep it low, and I press in with my my pelvis.
With your waist. My hips. Yeah.
Yeah. I do not like it high and me pressing my shoulders and arms and forearms. It's way easier to just drop your hands and push in. But you know that all it all depends on the kind of work you do. Like if you make a knife, you want to see the top of the bevel. You want it to be closer to your eyes. And with handles, you just have to practice. And sometimes, you know, you learn little tricks that just improve things. And the only way to do that is to just keep doing it. Like you make 100 and you learn one little thing. You make another 100 and one little thing. 100 and another little thing. And once you put it all together, you know, 10% on top of 10% on top of 10% on top of 10%, you know, after like 5 times, you're cutting your time in half. No, that's not perfect math, but it's something like that, right?
The beauty of editing. Once again, a disconnect, and who knows what's going on, if it's one of our connections or what, but right around here, we started talking about finish on your axe handles, and oh, man, I wish this was not gone, but it's gone. And yeah, you'll hear right away kind of how we ended up that conversation bit maybe, but yeah, what's there is there. Apologize for the technical difficulties once again, and hope you enjoy. Good day.
Yeah, we're back
again. Oh, we're back now again, so
hopefully all of the previous recordings actually come through so that I have the ability to patch them together and edit it. In the long run, we'll find out. So the fit and the finish of the axe handles and whatnot, it's work for it. Practice, yeah. Practice,
it's all practice.
Practice makes perfect, right? Yeah. That's what they say. Or it doesn't make perfect, but the more you practice, the closer you get to achieving that. But you just keep on practicing and trying to achieve it more and more and more so.
Yeah. You have to, you know, you have to aim to, when you start, it takes a really long time, but you have to aim to make it perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And once you do that, then you can start building on top of it. You have to, you know, crawl before you can walk, before you can run.
Yeah.
You have to start slow, and once you build up your experience, you can find little tricks to make things quicker and better.
Making your own handles too, dude?
I sometimes make my own handles. I did make a lathe, like a duplicator lathe, to make handles.
Oh, nice. But
it's, you know, I do it for specialty handles, for special stuff. For my regular handles, it was such a bear to find people, but I found a couple of people who have duplicator lathes, and I order from them usually, like, you know, a few hundred at a time, and that lasts me for however long.
Right on. So you give them a prototype, and then they duplicate it.
Yeah.
What's the chances that one of those gentlemen is Jack English Toolworks? Okay.
Zero. They're local people who don't usually do axe handles. They do other stuff. And they just have the right machine.
I know. Jack English is in the Ottawa region, and he runs one hell of a woodworking facility, dude. He might be able to help you out if you're looking for somebody else. That's
You know, the first man I found, he was up near Bancroft, and like I drove for 4 hours to find him. And that's the first place I went, and he had a real nice operation. And he did tool handles and canoe handles, canoe paddles. Baseball bats, like all sorts of kind of specialty stuff, but you know, I found other people in the meantime, but you know, it's always different. Like some guy will say, oh, I'm happy to work off a wooden pattern. Another person will say it needs to be aluminum, and is that working there?
Yeah, so
did I. Sorry, I thought cut out. Somebody else will say it has to be aluminum, and you know, it lasts you got to spend a fortune to get one made, or you have to make it yourself. Frankly, like I cast one out of aluminum, and it was so much work. So much work.
Oh,
that I just said, you know, I would have forged this quicker, like forged and ground it quicker. It's not worth it. But that's like a whole other game. That's why for specialty stuff, like if I only makes like 12 something a year, I built the pattern lathe, the duplicator lathe, and make it off that, make it on that. But something that I need like hundreds of, I send out. Because, you know, they also have a fee like to put it in the machine and run, and they're not going to do 10. It's not, unless you pay them, you know, unless you pay them like, I don't know what it would come out to, but a lot. So it's better than making your own. And, you know, I've made them on the grinder too, like cutting them out of bandsaw and doing shaping on the grinder. And sometimes if I just need one of something, I do it that way. Recently, I did an axe for my dad that way. Like we found in the 80s, my uncle commissioned an axe for my grandfather, and it was made in a factory there where my uncle worked in Poland, and gave it to my grandfather. So my uncle took the axe when my grandfather passed away, and so he had it and he gave it to me. And it's like a nice local pattern. He gave it to me, and I fixed it up on, I wanted to make like a Polish handle, which would be straight, like a classic kind of European handle. But my dad didn't want that. He wanted like a hickory handle. It's curved and nice, and you know, he really likes those. So I did that for my dad. But
hickory is your go-to. Hickory is your go-to axe material.
I use white ash and hickory. It just depends on the handle and what I'm doing with it, you know. But
no,
my
oak.
Dad wanted hickory, so I did hickory.
You wouldn't use oak at all?
No. It's too oak is, it's way too brittle.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It, like oak and maple, they're hard, but they if splinter. You hit them wrong or hit something wrong, they just shatter. Yeah, ash lasts a lot better, and hickory is insane. I've had top tools that somebody misstruck, and the handle bent like 45, and it was offset, like it used to be straight, it was offset like 3/4 of an inch. And all the grain was, looked like a cracked laminate that cracked in the glue. It was offset 3/4 of an inch, and the handle was still fine. Like it was still working.
Wow.
So that's, you're not going to get, if you did that, if you misstruck and you hit the handle of a top tool and it was oak or maple, it would shear, just break.
Right.
Ash would probably do that too, but hickory, no, it's incredible, and it's just way more tolerant. To
the only other wood that I've heard another axe maker swear by is birch.
You know, in Europe, they use, there's certain species of birch you can use, but for example, but like in some regions, ash doesn't grow that well. So I know in
Poland,
in Poland or in the Baltics, in Russia, they use like ash and what's it called?
Okay.
In English, locust.
Oh yeah.
Premium woods. Locust is also good in ocean.
Yeah.
Those are like specialty premium, but in Europe.
Yeah.
In Europe, they're considered kind of the premium wood, ash and locust. They also use a lot of birch.
Beech. Yeah.
Or beech, but beech is also brittle. Like if you have long handles, it's brittle.
Mm-hmm.
Elm. People use elm because it has very tight grain or a very interlocked grain.
Oh, that's good to know. Got a good selection of elm at breaking. Home.
Yeah, but you have to use hard elm. And the thing is, like if you look at tool design in Europe, their eyes, if you look at the eye of an axe, the European axe,
it's got a square.
North American axe. Well, it's not just that. It's not just the cross section. If you look at the volume of the eye, or let's say the volume of the cross section, or the area of the cross section, it's going to be twice as large. If you look at an American eye, it's basically, it's a teardrop, but let's call it a triangle. And a full-size axe, it's going to be 2.5 inches long, 3/4 of an inch wide. And let's call it a triangle. So you can, you know, multiply the 3/4 of an inch by the might be 7/8. Like multiply that by the 2.5, divide that in half, and you're gonna have the area. If you look at a European axe and you calculate the area of cross section, it's gonna be twice as thick. And their handles are way thicker. Like a sledgehammer, even an axe, it's almost like a pickaxe handle. A European handle is almost like a pickaxe handle. It's an inch thick.
Wow.
And it's longer. It's just a totally different tool. Like the handle weighs way more. With hickory, you can get away with a much, much smaller axe.
Interesting.
You can look at that if you find a European axe. Like small axes don't have big eyes, but if you get like a 3-pound or 4-pound, you know, you can look at steel axes. They're common. And I'm talking specifically about classic European tools. Like if you get a Swedish axe and they use hickory and they have American eyes, then it's not the same thing. If you get a German axe, like a steel axe, go to your local steel dealer or whatever, somebody who sells steel tools. See their axes. Look at the cross section of the eye. It's twice as big as an American axe. Because they don't have hickory, so they have to make the eye bigger. Sledgehammers. Go to Princess Auto and look at the Oscar tool. It's Oscar or Oscar. They have the Italian, they actually have a carpenter's hatchet there you can look at. And they have sledgehammers. Their sledgehammer handles are twice as big as that. American sledgehammer handle.
Like
European hand hammers have as big of eyes as American like 8-pound sledges. You have to look at if you know like Czech hammers or like Czech style hammers, they have really big eyes. All European hammers almost do compared to North American style. An American sledge, like even a 4-pound sledge, it has a fairly like a hand sledge. You know, like a double faced classic American kind of sledgehammer handle, but on an 18-inch handle, or hammer, but on an 18-inch handle. It's going to have a fairly small eye compared to the European.
Interesting. Hammer. Very cool. I think it was Nils Ogren, actually, if I'm not mistaken, that brought up the fact that he's using birch on his handles. Because of the lack of ash and hickory.
So, hickory. And you can get such beautiful color out of hickory. We use it in our knife making classes all the time. And you get a little spalting in that. And whoa, it's beautiful stuff.
Yeah, you can get that. I mean, there's so many different colors. You can get that beautiful white or
the,
like really rich, almost kind of like an orange brown.
Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure.
Variation.
Your axe material, are you using 41 or 4340 for your hammers or axes as well? You said you used it for your tools.
41. I use
4142.
Because, so 4142, because 4140, it has a spec'd carbon range of about 38 to 42 or 40. It's like 37 to 43 points carbon, something like that.
Yeah.
4142 is guaranteed to be on the higher end of that range. And the difference is the difference between like 83 Rockwell or 37 points carbon and 42 or 45 points carbon is going to be like 2 or 3 Rockwell points. I'm going off the top of my head from stuff like years ago, but it's something like that. So let's say the hardness of 4140 as quenched is supposed to be between 50, I believe it's supposed to be between 54 and 56 Rockwell or something like that. With 4142, you're guaranteed to get on the higher end of the range. So 55, even like 4142 is going to be between 0.4 and 0.45 points carbon, something like that. So you're guaranteed to get on the higher end above 55 Rockwell.
So where do you want?
This makes for a longer lasting edge.
Where do you want the hardness of your axe after tempered?
Between 50 and 55.
Yeah.
kind of 56. It just, you know, I want it to be hard enough to file, basically. Like, you know, if somebody ever gets damage on it, whatever, they can fix it up. But I don't want it soft.
What are you tempering to?
I aim for about 400, 425.
Two cycles, 2 hours?
I do, it depends on, the axe. I even do like three cycles. Just because, you know, just getting, you got to run the oven anyway, and it's all up to heat, so you might as well.
Yeah. Do you you test in between cycles to see how your hardness is, or?
Yeah, I do a file test.
Yeah,
you know, as quenched, and then or like, you know, you get the decarb off and you check it.
Yeah.
And afterwards.
Very cool, dude. I don't know. Got any other questions we want to? But getting late for Paul there, 11 o'clock in his end. So.
Yeah.
Poor guy's got a business to run.
Yeah. And nobody to help him. Nobody. Yeah.
No, it's all right. Like I said, right now, I mean, I don't even have my shop set up here. I'm fixing up the one here, the new shop.
It is. I know.
Yeah, that's a lot of work.
What's your secret to marketing?
I don't have a secret to marketing. I just post stuff online and I see what's kind of happening, and it's always changing. Like with Instagram, posting pictures used to be enough. Now pictures get nothing.
No, you need reels.
Videos used to be good, and then videos are nothing. Now you need reels, and you need you need to edit them very heavily, and you have to catch people's attention because you're competing with everything that you can find on the internet. So it's just all sorts of stuff, and I don't know. I don't know exactly how all that's going, because even Instagram, like, I don't know if Instagram isn't dead, right? Like, if it's not better to go on TikTok, I don't have a TikTok, but TikTok, YouTube Shorts, Reels on Instagram, you have to, I don't know, you always have to stay on top of everything.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Do you have to stay on top of it? I mean, it depends on.
If you don't post, you don't stay relevant, and then people lose you.
But.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it depends on what your business needs. You know, do you.
Yeah. Well, yeah. If you do railings and architectural stuff, then you only have to talk to like architects and interior designers, and they keep recommending you. It's all word of mouth. It doesn't matter. One job keeps you going for a year. If you're doing small stuff like I do, or like any business, if you're an HVAC guy, you just need your name on the truck and people like, you know, to call you and show up on YouTube or Google searches. Like, you know, my city, furnace repair, and somebody's going to find you. Like, I get calls for locksmithing, like a few calls for locksmithing a few times a year, because people don't know the difference between locksmith and blacksmith. If you're a manufacturer, or, you know, a tradesman, a craftsman, people have to find you somehow.
Mm-hmm.
You have to do that with marketing. I don't know how you do it otherwise.
No, you got to keep relevant. You got to keep pounding out there. And do you sell your axes overseas?
You know, I do send stuff sometimes, but like to Europe usually, but sometimes Australia and New Zealand. I mean, I've had people want to buy stuff in China, but I don't know. Like when you ship stuff, sometimes it's weird. It comes back and you don't know why. There's no explanation when you're out $100 on the shipping. And you don't even get an explanation. I don't.
So where's the bulk?
And you kind of.
Yeah. Where's the bulk of your customers coming? Where are the bulk of your customers?
It's Canada and the U.S.
Oh,
I think I'm, I don't know, man. I'm, my brain is wish-washed, dude. We could keep talking about so much when it comes to the blacksmithing stuff, and I could keep you guys busy for another couple hours easily, but try to keep the conversation on point, give the listeners some good information, and keep them not bored. So I feel like we're starting to meander through finding questions. I've got a
No problem. No, it's getting
It's getting late.
Shower and
oh shit. Yikes, buddy.
We got in late, and I had to. I just hopped on this, try to get this going.
Well, Paul, thank you very much for joining us, sir, and telling us your story and sharing everything you've shared with us, man.
Sure. That was a really great conversation. Thank you very much. And
Well. Like I said, thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Hopefully, some people got some good answers.
Well, I'm going to start cranking out some axes.
Start cranking out some axes.
Yep. I'll look forward to seeing them.
Oh, I'm going to crank them out.
Is that what you said too, Paul? let's see what you got, Nick.
I'd like to see them.
Yeah. Well,
bro down, throw down.
Yeah. I'll get on it. All right. Done and done.
Make an axe too.
Done and done. I'll start tooling up. Dude. Yeah, it does. Actually, I just got a drift from Front Step Forge for an axe, so I just have to clean it up and get smacking some eyes.
I've made a couple axes myself, but I've used the hammer drift for the eye of that. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I've made a bunch of tomahawks.
Did you see the way the look on Paul's face when I said that?
I did not.
There's nothing wrong with that. All over the world, the axe eye shape is different. Like in India, they're round. A lot of the world
is
round. Yeah. I mean, there's some cool videos of like Indian tool forging. Like they make these even by hand. These little tomahawks. There's one, I saw one video, they made it in two heats. Like I had two strikers. They made it out of a leaf spring. It was a nice tomahawk.
Oh, that's awesome. You
know, it's really cool. And it's a round eye. And then they have like these slitting axes, which they make with round eyes. So there's nothing wrong with the round eye. It's kind of a different tool. Just make it.
Yeah.
But it can work. It can work the same. Like this, the tomahawk style has a thin blade. Sledge has a thick blade. Thick blade, but they're all round. It really doesn't matter. It's just the way you're using
it. Right.
Yeah. Not everybody likes the round handle. In the West, kind of oval shape is better.
Well, maybe I'll continue doing it. Maybe I'll continue doing it the way I do it, and that'll be the way I do it. Fuck. Deal with it. You don't like it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you figure out a way to make it that way, then make it that way. It's not a problem.
Look at that.
There you go.
That's what matters, right?
Yeah.
On that note, Paul, thanks again. Let's freaking wrap this boy up with a coo 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 coo.